detective in Steinbeck's, that at the end he does show that he's going on to it. But one of the things about Steinbeck that I don't understand, he was given that material by the women lettuce workers. I don't understand, he made he didn't acknowledge it. But he never wrote like that again, or he never believed like that. He gave him a manuscript that high of the women organizers and the women lettuce workers with all the speech and the whole characters. It was almost used, and they wanted him to use it because they wanted something written about that. But I think they expected to have an acknowledgement of it or something. But he got all that material from these women lettuce workers, and some of it was just verbatim. That's okay, but I mean, that's a good thing to have a writer, use a writer to do that. But he never acknowledged it, which I thought was really strange. I don't know how to account for the popularity of the Book of Times, of course, and the fact is that you are not going to be much afraid of these workers. I think it has something to do with it. Like this terrible recorder of workers, what's his name? Cage. He goes and tapes starving Appalachian children, and he changes their language. I read it because I thought I'd see wonderful Appalachian speech. He puts them all into first-class grammar. It's really, you can't imagine how it murders the whole feeling, and you never know that any of them acknowledged or held in themselves any kind of revolt or even passion against their condition. I mean, I think they're just horrible, horrible books. And there's so many like that where you change the language. Those books put me on the whole feeling about language being a way of manipulation. Because those were bestsellers, and they were $18. Who was buying those? Lettuce eaters who didn't want to admit there was blood on their lettuce. Well, I wish you'd answer that question. It's very important in our literature, I think. It has something to do with writing objectively, or not being part, or not being partisan. It has something to do with Freire, the saying that you should not write in your oppressor's language. This Brazilian educator, he teaches the worker should not learn the language of the oppressor. Then he wouldn't understand Regan at all. I mean, he'd understand that he's lying, that everything is opposite. It's a very interesting thing in America to think about, because I think we have a great culture that is anti-establishment. We have a great language that is not establishment language, not academic language, not grammatical. I think our great genius of language is in the people's language. It comes out of their work, out of their relationships, and is not grammatical. Somebody's been shaking commas and periods over my work lately, my notebooks. And you'd be surprised how the meaning changes. I have 149 notebooks that I've written all my life, and there's no punctuation in it. And some of these passionate academia, is that the right way to use that great word? can change the whole meaning by giving them a severe bureaucratic orthodox grammatical structure. So I'm answering them by writing a nounless novel. No nouns. Well, Einstein said that you couldn't express relativity in the English language because you have a language that means either this or that. You have no synthesis, and you have no. We couldn't get out of Vietnam. You had to win or lose. I mean, you know, there's nothing in between. There's no third thing there, and it's true of our foreign policy is probably injured by the lack of intermediate language, a language that creates a synthesis of the thesis and the antithesis and the synthesis. It's very serious, I think. The Indian language has no nouns. The American Indian, I'm talking about, has no nouns. It only has the relationship. That's what Einstein meant. You couldn't express the relationship in the English language. And that's the relativity. Just imagine the American Indian language has no nouns. It only has the relationship of things. For example, the Indian woman told me there's no word for rock. No such thing as a rock. Just an object. If the rock is coming to hit you in the stomach, it has one phrase. If you're throwing a rock at your worst enemy, it has entirely other meaning. The rock, nature of the rock has changed. But we just have a rock, you know, and it's always a rock, and you can... I think that's related to grabbing things, or to using things, or making commodities out of things. You know, you just have to destroy the relationship to make a commodity. You destroy everything, it only becomes related to selling. And that's what a lot of our life, you know, the land situation, for example, is related to that. It's only become a price that has no reality. Very serious problem, I think, in our culture. Well, maybe you can't exploit anything without objectifying it. I mean, maybe to drop the bomb, maybe you have to have an abstract, objectified sense of who you're dropping it on, or people. You must not care for them or be related to them to drop it. I think that I call it the linear thought of our society leads to the bomb. A straight line leads to all the destruction of our... If you're going on a straight line towards a goal, you can do anything you want. Pollute the waters, that's called progress. And you achieve your goal, that's ruin. When you achieve that goal you're going linearly toward, you destroy it. I believe you could say that the bomb is a result of the linear thinking towards... The goal is destruction. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that philosophy leads to the possibility of thinking of destroying your enemy, or thinking that you have an enemy.
Any other questions? There is a reception afterwards. I mean, there's some thing to drink back there, and some pretzels and other things to snack on, and you can still talk to Meridell if you wish.
I was interviewed by NBC. But when you get to be interviewed by NBC, you become a commodity. You know, you're interviewed not as a person. Of course, the mere fact that you go there and ask them to talk about your book is a form of prostitution. I call it poorly paid prostitution. But this interviewer asked me if my children were illegitimate in the interview. I said, well, I never heard of any illegitimate children. I didn't know there were illegitimate children. Afterward, I said, would you ask a man that question? Well, he said, of course not. He said, but he said, I thought you were going to say that you were against marriage. And I said, well, why did you assume I'm against marriage? I'm crazy about marriage. But imagine asking a woman a question like that. I mean, the kind of looking at you as a commodity. It was the most degrading experience I've ever had, to be interviewed as a commodity. In fact, I never put myself up as... I would never do it again if I was starving. The feminist press sold me the idea that they had needed money, and if they would promote what is called promote you into hell, I call it, that they would sell the first edition of a book if you're taken over by that route, by the Madison Square. I'm interviewed and have a review in the New York Times that you'll sell out your... And that's what happened. But you enter that world. I tried to write a series of articles called Fascist Interviews. And that's what they were. It was a fascist attitude towards creative work, towards women, and towards creative life. And then what especially offended me was that my friends, both liberals and radicals, thought it was wonderful. Really, I congratulated you. I said, well, how can you do that? I congratulated you about being eaten by the lion and stroke his gullet as you go down. But they thought that was wonderful to get into that world. It made me ill. I would have died if I stayed there and been in that world. I got heart trouble and high blood pressure. I can't convey to you the horror of that world. The whole thing was looking at you, you know, and the awful thing was that you responded. The other thing is you began to respond to that horrible thing, you know, telling things funny, telling funny stories, or demeaning and belittling things, you know, the whole thing based upon amusement. You're being consumed, eaten like a steak. So you find yourself becoming a rich, good steak, you know, please like me. You begin to be depraved yourself. I mean, I can't describe how awful I began to respond, you know, to this horrible flattery and innuendo and telling a funny story. You say, well, I was going to commit suicide after the first whirl. Well, that's funny. Really, were you? Did you succeed? I just can't express the horror of that whole thing. Then I was waiting to get back home to my home base and have some farmer ask me, what did you do to get into the New York Times? Are you a stool pigeon now? And sure enough, I was healed by a farmer asking me, what did you do to get in the New York Times? I felt all right then for a while.
Thank goodness for the farmers.
Huh?
I said, thank goodness for the farmers.
Thank goodness.
We'll stop. But talking about farmers, I was laying in the grass after the march in Washington, and this man was talking to me, and I didn't want to respond because I was so tired. And I finally turned over, and there was this old man who's had a Farmers Alliance hat on, and I looked at him, and he said he was from Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. I said, do you know Mayor Del Lesueur? And he got this little grin on his face, and he said, sure. And we talked, and I shook his hand, because his hand was like leather, you know, it was so wonderful. And that sort of made my day, you know, after that whole experience. So, yeah, that to be confused with a farmer, and also, I'll stop, but Maridel was asking me who some people are in the audience at the last talk, and he said, God, they look beautiful, they look just like farmers. About the best compliment you can give. Anyhow, this reception is here, and Maridel will be here for a while if you want to talk. If you, a couple of people I know have some books that they'd like here to autograph, and, you know, feel free. Thanks very much.